Protagonist, check. Antagonist, check. Deuteragonist, what? Tritagonist, what? Are those types of antagonist? No. Chorus, well, no singing in my book. What can someone who lived 2,400 years ago teach us about characters and writing? More than you would believe. Welcome to The Right to Focus, a podcast for writers at all levels, headed up by M.A. Lee, with the assistance of Remy Black and Edie Runes, all from Writers Inc. Books. Our focus is productivity, process, craft, and tools. Show notes for this and other episodes can be found on therightfocus.blogspot.com. Write to us at winkbooks@aol.com. Our podcast episodes last as long as it takes to fix a quick dinner, drive a short commute, or take a brisk walk. We're bookcasting with Think Like a Pro by M.A. Lee, copyright 2017, revised 2018. Today we finish the fourth chapter, One Ancient Greek. Aristotle rocks characters. He's our foundation for everything we writers understand about characters and a good bit more. Last episode, we looked at Aristotle's five essentials for plot, and that's a character-driven story, or a character-illuminated plot. This time, we look at Aristotle's essential characters for drama. But you say, I'm writing a novel, not a play. That's okay. Aristotle is the foundation for plot. All plot methods universally match to Aristotle's requirements for plot. He did the same thing for characters. Once you have your story started and you know it's going to be a story, you need to stop and deepen your characters so they will live and breathe. When first we writers consider a situation, the character who confronts it is what we find intriguing. Beyond the protagonist, Aristotle gives us four more essential character types to support and to oppose the primary character. The Greek word agon is translated as conflict. When the primary character is called the protagonist, we see that agon at the center of the word. This reminds us that conflict should be at the center of your primary character's development and story arc. Agon gives us the modern word agony. Any characters involved in the conflict should agonize over their actions and reactions to events and other characters. A protagonist especially should agonize when they must sacrifice something dear in order to achieve their desired goals. Now, when we refer to characters in opposition to the protagonist, we refer to them as antagonist. The Greek agon is also at the center of this word. Antagonist was not a specialized term in Aristotle's day. Instead of antagonist, we'll examine two character terms that you may find new. For now, though, we start with the protagonist, the primary character facing the conflict. Pro is a prefix for confronting. With the agon, the protagonist is clearly the primary character confronting the conflict. This reminds us to keep our protagonist active, not drifting or reeling from situation to situation. While the weaknesses and the fatal flaws of hamartia are good, better for our protagonist would be deep-seated fears that drive them away from the action they must take. When I say fear, I'm not talking about agoraphobia or claustrophobia or even misophobia, fear of germs. These are strong, irrational fears that cause panic attacks. I am talking about secrets. Give to your primary characters a secret or two that they are highly motivated to keep. The revelation of the secret would destroy them not only publicly but personally, both their outward lives and their inward images of themselves. The secret should connect to haunting past events, often called ghost. That past taints their present, as well as everything they plan for the future, and the characters will twist themselves into pretzels to stop any revelation of the secret. The secret stain should plant a seed of corruption in every aspect of their life. The antagonist, the primary conflict creator, should seek a goal that is mirrored to the protagonist. Their conflict may be over the same treasure, the same career advancement, or the same approbation from the community. The antagonist may want the destruction of what the protagonist is trying to create. He or she will twist any concept that the protagonist developed to improve the world. Both protagonist and antagonist should work equally hard to achieve their goals. They are in a constant push-pull synergy. We usually view the antagonist as one of several types of villains. However, we need to remember the roles of two other character types, which we'll get to later. Not all people are evil. Not all people want to hurt others. Most people in a community want to help their fellows. Nevertheless, a presentation of antagonist would not be complete without a brief acknowledgement of modern conflict creators. There are five basic forms of conflict. Man versus man, as in Godfather 2, man versus self in Wild, man versus nature, which has further developed into technology or machine, as in Castaway, man versus society in The Hunger Games, and man versus God, which extends into the supernatural realm as well as any discussion of ancient evil. Interview with the Vampire. Here are five simple antagonists. Villain, an over-the-top bad guy. The classic example is Snidely Whiplash in the Dudley Do-Right cartoons. A straw man, a character set up as a one-sided evil who is easy to defeat, as in The Devil Wears Prada. Bully, the stereotypical bully tries to intimidate those who are weaker. When confronted, the bully runs away like a coward. That was the Karate Kid. Beast, large and dangerous, feared because the primary motivation is animal-based and thus lacks human mercy, food or predator hunting prey. Jaws are the gray. Alien, the off-world stranger, with unknown strengths and motivations, unknown weaknesses and reactions. Alien or predator. Here are five not-so-simple antagonists. Most writers do not write these not-simple evil doers as they truly are. They back off once the story gets going. When writers do follow through, we readers and audience get a memorable story that others try to imitate. The Corrupted, as in Anatomy of a Murder, or Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. The Femme Fatale, as in Basic Instinct. The Mastermind, as in Terminator. The Criminal, Moriarty, in the new Sherlock series. And the Disturbed, Hannibal. The best antagonist is not an antagonist at all, the perfect person, as in Mary Crawford in the 2007 Mansfield Park. In looking at Aristotle, we are reminded that the best creators of agon are good people trying to do good things. For Aristotle, the antagonist did not exist as a character. The conflict came from within. Instead, he presents these following two character types as necessary for dramatic situations: deuteragonist and tritagonist. Deuter is D-E-U-T-E-R, and it means second. Agon, of course, gives us conflict. The deuteragonist originally came on the ancient Greek stage to confront the protagonist with a second dilemma in addition to facing her or his own conflict. This character is not a villain. They're just like us, trying to make good decisions, trying to do what's best. However, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Good intentions are not enough. They can and do lead to us offering people a free pass, only to have them commit greater evils. Good intentions often keep us from acting when we should, primarily because we are trying to be nice. The perfect example is Corinth's King Creon in the ancient drama of Medea by Euripides. His daughter has recently married the hero Jason. Medea's love and husband, although Jason claimed that a barbaric marriage didn't count. Creon wants to protect his daughter from Medea's wrath. He wants to protect his city. Medea's past murders are well known. To help Jason, she killed her own brother and his uncle. Creon knows that he must get rid of Medea. The easiest choice is to have her executed, but she hasn't actually committed a crime in his city, just elsewhere. He decides she must leave, and so he orders Medea and her children into exile. Now, Creon himself was in exile. He knows how difficult being outcast and alone is. He knows what happens to those who are weak and without protection. He knows that Medea and her children will starve. They will be helpless prey for beast and men. Therefore, with the best of intentions, Creon gives Medea a half day before she must leave. He thinks she will use that half day to hire protection and gather supplies and liquidate any assets that she cannot take with her. He doesn't know that she will use it to set in motion a horrific plan that will lead to his daughter's terrible death, his own death when he tries to save his daughter, and the deaths of the children of Jason and Medea. Yes, Medea killed her own children. She's evil. Another example of a deuteragonist is Friar Lawrence in Romeo and Juliet. He wants to help the two young lovers. He believes that marrying them will end the feud. These are worthy intentions. Thus, he agrees to perform the marriage ceremony, even though it occurs in secret, and he really has no authority to perform it. He's a friar, not a priest. In trying to do good, he participates in a lie and a crime, the secret marriage, and the impersonation of a priest. The friar also gives Juliet the potion that will put her in a death-like sleep. He does this so she can avoid a bigamous marriage. This is an even worthier intention. However, the letter he sent to Romeo Mantua, which would have explained that Juliet was not dead, that letter never reaches its destination. Romeo hears that Juliet is dead, and thus begins the chain of events that will lead to three more deaths. Tritagonist. Tri, of course, means third. And there again is the agon for conflict. Just like the deuteragonist, the tritagonist presents a third conflict for the protagonist, even as this character confronts a conflict of his own. Here we have another good person trying to do the right thing, only to suffer because of their good intentions. Also from the ancient Greek drama Medea, we have the character of Aegeus, who has no son and therefore no heir to the throne of Athens. He is a former friend of Jason and knows Medea because of him. Newly arrived in Corinth and caught up in his own troubles, he doesn't really know what's been happening between Jason and Medea and at the palace. When Medea tells him that she must enter exile, Aegeus basically said, "That's bad." When she says that people who hurt others should be punished, he basically says, "That's what you would think." And when she says, "Let's make a bargain. You give me protection in Athens, and I'll ensure you have a son." And he agrees. Then she makes him swear that if he goes back on his vow of protection, he will only see blackness in the sky. Now Aegeus is worried, but he swears. His agony comes many years later in the story of Theseus. When his yet unknown son arrives in Athens, he wants Medea to poison the young hero. She agrees. Fortunately, Aegeus recognizes his son Theseus in time, and Medea is banished from Athens. Theseus then goes to Crete to prevent King Minos from sacrificing Athenian youth to the Minotaur. He successfully defeats the monster and returns home. Aegeus awaits the return of his only son and heir on the cliff. From that great height, he will see the ship's return. If Theseus succeeded, he was to raise white sails on the ship. If Theseus dies, black sails will fly. Theseus forgets to change the sails. When he sees only blackness in the sky, Aegeus leaps to his death, thinking his only son and heir is dead. In Romeo and Juliet, three characters serve as examples of the tritagonist. These are Mercutio, Benvolio, and Count Paris. They are also foils for Romeo, mirroring a certain element of his character. Let's focus on Count Paris. He loved Juliet and wanted to marry her. However, Juliet's marriage to Paris would be bigamous. She is already married to Romeo. Thus, Paris creates a dilemma for her. She does not want to break man's law about marriage, nor does she want to break the law of her heart, which is devoted to Romeo. She runs to Friar Lawrence for help, and he gives her the death-like sleep potion. The proof we have of Count Paris's love of Juliet comes at the end. Believing she is dead, he is placing flowers at her tomb, a nightly vigil. When he sees Romeo coming, he recognizes that here is the man who caused her such grief that she died. He confronts Romeo, who warns Paris that he has nothing to lose. He draws a sword and demands Romeo leave the site of the tomb. Obviously, he thinks Romeo has come to desecrate the body of his enemy, Tybalt. Romeo, of course, no longer cares what he does in this life. His only intention is to die beside Juliet, their bodies lying together in the tomb. Their confrontation quickly becomes another sword fight, the third one in the play. Paris is no match for Romeo. Another character type that Aristotle requires is the chorus. In ancient Greece, the chorus truly was a group singing or chanting to the audience. The chorus even began with choreographed steps. Primarily, though, the chorus interacted with the protagonist, providing reactions to the protagonist and information for the audience. In modern stories, the chorus has become side characters who, 1, illuminate information, or 2, bolster and support the protagonist, or 3, serve as a minion for the antagonist. These side characters reveal the primary characters through their interactions. Classically, the chorus has three roles. One, provide exposition, background, and situation. For example, a mentor who makes the protagonist examine what's been and what could be. Two, provide social commentary and expected reactions, emotional and logical, such as the good friend, the confidant. Three, announce entrances. The character who says, "Who is that person?" Info dump can ruin a story. Writers can instead use dialogue to present the information through conversation. This avoids the author rattling words onto the page and boring the reader. Of course, the best way to info dump is to scatter it throughout the story. Aristotle did not individually classify these characters. We find the chorus enacting these roles. Some are from the Italian Commedia dell'arte. Some are archetypes. Here's my list of characters designed to illuminate your protagonist and antagonist. Threshold guardian, determined to block the protagonist's passage. Ally, the helpful and worthy friend who always has the protagonist back. Foil, a character who in many respects is just like the protagonist. You can have more than one. In Romeo and Juliet, Shakespeare had four: Mercutio, Benvolio, Paris, and Tybalt. Foils will highlight the protagonist's weakness or flaw, and fail to stand against the trial that undermines their weakness. Thus, their failure helps the protagonist prepare for their own test. Boromir and Aragorn are examples of a foil for a protagonist in The Fellowship of the Ring. Love interest. In Oed's stories, the woman that the protagonist loved was often merely a walk-on character. Now the love interest is a woman side by side with a man. Even better, the woman is the protagonist and the man is the love interest. Blocking figure. Characters who have the best intentions for the protagonist but stand in the way. Juliet's parents are great examples. These can also be minions who serve, requiring responsibility from the protagonist to look after them. Idol, the character that the protagonist has looked up to but who is revealed as having clay feet. Harold comes onto the stage to deliver important information. Jokester, he plays to an audience. He doesn't care about the audience's derision as long as he gets laughter. His actions are actually reactions, a cyclical feeding off of the audience. Trickster, a character who thinks himself clever, but his actions only cause problems for everyone else. Ulysses is a trickster. He successfully finds a way to get his men out of the cave of the Cyclops before another one can be eaten. He also managed to blind the monster to ensure their escape. Enraged at being blinded and losing his dinner, the Cyclops chucks boaters around, hoping to injure the men who escaped him. And this is where Ulysses reveals his arrogance about being clever. He must tell the Cyclops who blinded him. In doing so, he gives the Cyclops a direction to aim the boaters and nearly sinks the ship they are escaping on. And then the Cyclops prays to his ancestor Poseidon to punish Ulysses. Poseidon does so. Ulysses is a clever idiot. That's a simple explanation for trickster. Shapeshifter comes in two forms. Form 1, the character that is trusted is actually working for the antagonist. Form 2, the character that no one trusts, who is actually very trustworthy. In the introduction and chapter 1, I talked about this character as the seeming ally. Aristotle's last character to include in every story is the Deus ex machina. Literally, this is the god out of the machine. In ancient Greek dramas, sometimes the protagonist would have no possible way out of the dilemma. Enter the Deus ex machina. A god would intervene, providing some miracle that kept the hero from dying. Audiences in Aristotle's time loved the Deus ex machina. The ancient Greeks celebrated the god's arrival as a religious ceremony. The dramas, of course, were part of religion, running for several days in a festival. This means that the Deus ex machina would be celebrated for saving the day, like a mighty mouse come to rescue when no other rescue was humanly possible. Modern audiences and readers, however, frown upon such sudden anticipated escapes. They consider it a weakness by the writer. We call Deus ex machina a coincidence. When coincidence is unexplained or unexpected, the logical part of our catharsis is unexplained and unacceptable. The best example of the infuriating Deus ex machina is a mystery when the detective suddenly finds out the answer through a letter or other clue which is not shared with the audience. All is now clear, the detective declares. Well, to her it is. As for the rest of us, we change the channel or throw the book across the room, print version, not the ebook. An example of the outside hand saving a character recently occurred in the excellent TV series Vera. This police procedural is based on the books by Anne Cleves. A deus ex machina occurs in Series 2, Episode 4. The dead drug dealer's son stops the dead drug addict's mother from committing suicide. As she lost her purpose when she lost her son, he lost his purpose in trying to connect to his now murdered father. Deus ex machina occurs by placing him on the bridge just as she climbs the railing to jump off the bridge. It's a neat juxtaposition. He needs parenting. She needs a child. He saved her physical life. She will save his intellectual and emotional life. But the deus ex machina nags at us. It's a weakness that could be resolved with foreshadowing. Cleves likely resolved the issue in her book. The foreshadowing may have been cut from the telepele. When we resort to coincidence or an outside hand that saves the protagonist or any character from doom or causes the doom when it could be avoided, then we should set it up with foreshadowing. In an ancient story, the hero would call upon the god to save him. He would make an offering, and an eerie response to that offering, such as the fire leaping 3 times, would show a god actively aware of the hero. Another such touch in the center of the story, such as fog mysteriously blowing away, would set up the god's continued involvement. Nothing more need be done. In a modern story, the protagonist could escape doom by the timely arrival of a subway, or the inconvenient friend's visit, or the scary neighbor who's not as evil as the antagonist. Of course, the scary neighbor, lifting weights in the hall, cleaning his gun on the balcony shared with the protagonist, bandaging a wounded arm, could just as easily work for the antagonist. The subway's arrival can be foreshadowed by having the protagonist take it into the town much earlier in the story. The inconvenient friend can drop in early and in the story's middle, just as the protagonist needs to be somewhere else. Then both subway and inconvenient friend can reappear at the necessary moment. As a writer, when you discover a deus ex machina is needed, in this lovely age of computers, it's easy to add foreshadowing. The key is to keep the foreshadowed elements as simple shadows, brief touches, noticed and gone, in the same way mystery writers plant clues and red herrings. With these early essentials for characters, and last week with a plot for a character-illuminated story, Aristotle provides us with tons of assistance in understanding well-written characters. That geeky Greek may be ancient, but he rocked the foundations of character for us. Thanks for listening to The Right Focus. Next Wednesday, we start with any writer's biggest bugbear, writer's block. Until then, write on.